Welcome to Season 4 of Marcus Oldham Ag Talk, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of agriculture. Stories to challenge your views, expert insights, and the latest thinking that relates to ag. Hosted by David Cornish, we're thrilled to guide you through the dynamic and ever-evolving landscape of agriculture. So buckle up and get ready for another season of Ag Talk. Whether you're a seasoned ag industry pro, a current student, or simply someone who's passionate about agriculture, there's something here for you. Our guests are industry thought leaders, farmers, researchers, and entrepreneurs who are making a difference in the ag world one innovation at a time. Season 4 of Marcus Oldham Ag Talk's our best one yet, and we can't wait to have you on board. Thanks for tuning in, and let's get ready to explore the wonderful world of agriculture together.
It's my pleasure to welcome Andrew Henderson, Principal of AgSecure, to Ag Talk Podcast. He is a leading strategic policy specialist with a passion for building the sustainability and prosperity of rural and regional Australia and enhancing the recognition of its role in the economy and its place in national security. Andrew's mission is to support industry and government to understand each other and work better together for the benefit of the nation, working across private enterprise, industry, not-for-profit and governments. Andrew will be one of the keynote speakers at the inaugural Australian Future Ag Trade Exhibition and conference set to showcase the future of the Australian agricultural industry. The exhibition has been held at the Melbourne Showgrounds from Wednesday the 17th of April to Friday the 19th of April. Tickets are available from the website futureagexpo.com.au. Andrew will be sharing his knowledge and insight of agriculture, food and Australia's national security. He will be diving deep into critical challenges associated with supply chain, sustainability, technology and biosecurity. Welcome, Andrew, to the Ag Talk podcast. First of all, how are you going?
Really well, David. Thank you very much for having me. We're enjoying a bit of this East Coast low pressure system that seems to be coming across here at the moment, giving us a bit of a break, a nice autumn break.
Well, I'd really appreciate it if you could send it down south. So given that, Andrew, where do we find you today?
We're about an hour north of Canberra, just outside of a town called Yass in New South Wales, and we're just on the edge of a thriving metropolis called Bowning, a village of about 600 or 700 people.
Andrew, before we get into the meat of the podcast today, I think it's worthwhile for you to give a little bit of a background about your professional career to date and how the listener can better understand why this issue that we're going to talk about today is you're so passionate about.
No worries. Well, I'm not sure whether I should start from now and work backwards or start from way back when and work forwards, but maybe I'll start from way back when. And realistically, I started my working life mostly working on a few different areas, but predominantly on cattle stations and properties both here and in North America. In my late 20s, I got involved in politics. Funnily enough, I got a job as an electorate officer, as a media and research advisor for a backbench politician up in central Queensland, in the federal electorate of Flynn, which is where my family's from, the Central Highlands. And then from there, I made my way down to Canberra and became a policy advisor for the then agriculture minister, who then became the deputy prime minister, Barnaby Joyce, and then finished there in 2016 at that election and went out and started my own business. Firstly, in investment facilitation, so that involved me with a lot of private equity firms, family offices, that type of stuff, really looking to try and place investment. At that time was pretty red hot, but found it pretty, it was a pretty difficult, cutthroat sort of world to make a living in. And just become a dad, got married, all that sort of stuff. So then found my way into doing some consulting work. So I established my own consulting business. But as well as that, became the independent chair of an organization called the Safe Meat Advisory Group. And the Safe Meat Advisory Group does a lot of work around, well, looks after advising on policy that sits behind all of the livestock traceability systems and, livestock and red meat integrity systems. So NLAS, Livestock Production Assurance Program, and others, particularly to do with the National Residue Survey and what have you. SafeMeat's effectively a platform of collaboration between all of the governments, so state and Commonwealth governments, as well as all of the national industry bodies right throughout the red meat and livestock supply chain, plus a few others like wool, kangaroos, would you believe it, in the dairy industry, anyone that has a buy-in to the export and domestic meat processing sector. And that's a role that I held up until about 4 or 5 weeks ago. So, that's pretty much me. I operate more or less on my own. I have a few other chair roles and now sit on the board of an organisation called End Food Waste Australia and Sheep Producers Australia as well, and a few other things keep me busy too, and as well as a bit of cattle trading and doing other things on the side, which is what I really enjoy doing. So that's me.
And I think that the reason why to bring that to your attention is you've almost had a unique or very, very unusual perspective on things, in that you've both worked for government and worked for private enterprise, and you can see the linkages and what's required in the formation of policy or the implementation of policy, and how bloody hard that is to do in Australia.
Yeah, it's absolutely difficult. I mean, if you watch the news and you understand how difficult it is to get anything like tax reform, healthcare reform, anything done between the states and the Commonwealth, and even the states amongst themselves, or even you know, good policy through at the Commonwealth level is pretty tricky. So, yes, it's a fairly gnarly world to operate within. But you know, look, a lot of my business really, you know, is predicated upon trying to help industry, particularly work better with government and help government and industry work better together, demystify the whole deal so that we can ultimately get better outcomes, you know, for the economy, for our business operating environment, for just we as people living in, you know, our society.
Okay, that brings us to the subject we're going to talk about today. And the subject is food security. And the first question I've got to ask is, having been in this game for a while, why should we worry? We're a major exporting industry of food. We've got lots of food. Why should we even sort of blink an eyelid about food security? Because it's, you know, can't we take it for granted?
Well, gee whiz, it's a big question. But the reality is, we are on face value absolutely a food secure nation. As your listeners would know, we export the vast bulk of what we produce, about 70% every year, depending on the commodity. But the reality is, we're also a production environment that's inherently reliant on inputs, a range of critical inputs that we don't have control over or have any sovereignty around necessarily. And so, you know, anyone who subscribes to James T. Reason's Swiss cheese theory would know that, you know, and actually it's an interesting one. I first came across that, you know, from one of my chiefs of staff working in politics that said, you know, you've got to watch out for that holes in the cheese deal. You know, one of those days that the holes in the cheese will line up and bang, you've lost your job, or your boss has lost your job. And I thought about that a lot and have since kind of applied that in a less, I guess, crass way to, you know, how we operate as a supply chain, as a sector, and looking at what our critical vulnerabilities are and some of the big lessons that we've learned, particularly through COVID, but not just COVID, the dramatic change that's taking place in Australia's strategic environment, that means that we've had some shocks and we've had some wake-up calls, I like to think. Empty supermarket shelves, you know, here domestically since COVID, unrelated to COVID-related supply chain disruptions, crises that are happening and unfolding in the Red Sea, the impacts that that's had on global shipping and freight movements and flows and costs, et cetera. All of these things, you know, seem like they're a long way away. But, you know, for us down here in Australia, we're kind of out of the way of the world. And for majority of our history, that's probably been advantageous for us. But these days, it's become a critical vulnerability in the sense that we're inherently reliant on our maritime trade routes for basically everything to get our product out, but also to get our critical inputs in. So the more that you think about that Swiss cheese theory scenario and you look at what our critical vulnerabilities are and you realise we're actually probably not too far from the water, you know, in a metaphorical sense, when we talk about how sustainable it is that we can continue to do what we do. You switch off our fuel supply, you switch off our fertiliser supply, you switch off our supply of labour, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation where your operating environment dramatically changes. And you know, the thing about COVID is that it's taught us that that's not actually unrealistic anymore. We've lived in a really, I guess, prosperous and largely peaceful environment, and it's been reasonably stable over decades. And now it's a point where, you know, I think we can expect that to change significantly. And that's what, you know, that's been the subject of some of the things that I've written about with regard to food security and why people should care about it and why people shouldn't take it for granted.
And I think that's a really important point. And let's start there is that let's look at the global environment as we sit here today. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned that over, 60 years almost, 60, 70 years, we've been through a period of, I would say generally, world political relationships which have been conducive to global trade. You know, yes, we've had the battles, yes, we've had Cold War and all those type of things, but reality is that we've been able to grow a very significant export market on based on a reasonably benign external environment. Would that be a fair call?
Absolutely. Yeah, I guess it's the... you know, the post Second World War, you know, global environment that's facilitated, you know, the prosperity of this of our nation and many others around the Western world. It's a world order that's been dominated by the West, by the values of economic liberalism. You know, it's a world of structures, of structured relationships between nations, by and large, minimal government intervention, you know, market based economic activity for the most part. But, you know, the reality is that's starting to change and it's starting to be deconstructed, and there's some significant competition to that world order, which, you know, has significant implications for us here as a sector.
And I think one of the things you say, we're so far away, maybe we don't take what's happening in Europe much heed, but, you know, the reality is when you've got the President of the EU and Defence Council talking about gearing up for conflict with Russia, not talking just Ukraine, we're talking about European Union or NATO. These discussions, I can't remember in my lifetime ever been had with regard to the seriousness of the issues over there. So it looks like we've got potential for significant conflict in Europe. Now let's take that to the next level. Let's come a bit closer to home. There is, as I understand it, there are people who are much wiser and much all over this than me, that if Ukraine falls, if we want to put it that way, then there is a strong likelihood that Taiwan will be next on the list. And there seems to be a retraction of the US across the globe with regards to becoming much more isolationist. Now, I haven't had that in my lifetime, and I have been alive for a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a situation where the political environment is changing rapidly. Mm-hmm. How does that affect Australia?
Well, yeah, it affects us because we're a relatively minor global player, or we call ourselves a middle power, which is I think true and correct. But we are effectively an incredibly trade exposed economy. I don't think over the course of our history, two-way trade's ever dipped below 20% of the value of GDP, and I think now it probably sits somewhere between 40 and 50%. So just about half of our GDP is reliant on two-way trade. The vast bulk of our exports come and go from this country via our maritime trade routes, and the vast bulk of that runs through the Indo-Pacific. And, you know, the Indo-Pacific has become some of the most hotly contested territory in the world. And I think that's, you know, when we talk about the world since the Second World War, I've always been inherently interested in that history. But what's really sort of made me sit up and pay attention was the government's release of the 2020 Defence Strategic Update, I think it was called. And that document had some really, really strong language, which, you know, I was actually quite surprised, having worked in government and understanding how carefully crafted and nuanced public statements are, that, you know, some of these documents this document was using language that I felt was really, really profound. And I was quite shocked, actually, that more people probably didn't really pay attention to it or necessarily take notice of it. But these things do have a habit of just passing us by, particularly, you know, 2020, as we know what happened in that year. But at that time, you know, the government stated that effectively along the lines of that our region was in the midst of the most consequential strategic realignment since the Second World War. and cited trends including military modernization, things like technical disruption, and the risk of state-on-state conflict, you know, is further complicating our nation's strategic circumstances. But it was this notion of sort of saying that, you know, we're living in this environment that's, you know, the most heightened environment since the end of the Second World War. We know what that meant for our region and the type of disruption and conflict that took place, you know, in the Asia, across the Asia-Pacific region during the Second World War. And sort of the thought that we could, our leaders could be talking about that being a potential reality again kind of really made me think. And then, you know, the more that you think about that, the more that you start to realise how, you know, trade exposed we are as a sector, and then what that trade exposure really means for the livelihoods, if you track that all the way back to the farm gate, what that means for the livelihoods of you and me and your listeners and everybody else. If we can't access the world, or if that access is disrupted, or if that access now has to come at twice or three times the cost because shipping routes have to be diverted and take vastly longer through less practical trade routes, or, you know, insurability of shipping becomes a huge issue via conflict and increased risk and so on, what does that do to our livelihoods? Mm. And it's not a conversation that I heard anybody outside of, and that I really have heard anybody outside of, the defence and national security circles talking about. And then, you know, from there, we move into the defence strategic review that got released, I think, in April in 2023. And that document talked about it in even more graphic terms in terms of the importance of the Indo-Pacific region and what's going on there for Australia's national interests. And that's fine and well and good to talk about from a purely national security defence and so on point of view, but you know, the subject of some of these talks that I've been doing over the last year or two, and we'll be discussing in more detail at Future Ag in Melbourne, is what that means for agriculture and how we're preparing for, you know, some of the, you know, potential future realities that our defence and national security colleagues are preparing for over on the other side of town.
Mm. So are we doing anything? Or, I mean, again, I suppose the question I was wanting to ask you, if you were PM for the day, or maybe a bit more than a day, and you had the magic wand, where would you start on all this stuff?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. If I was PM for the day, I'd probably just enjoy the office because that's about as much as I could achieve. But the reality is, where do you start? I think awareness is the first thing. And I think, you know, we can watch the news and we can read these documents and we can become, I guess, well, there's an element of fear that can creep into, you know, creep into our psyche when we're thinking about some of this stuff and what it may mean for us. But I think the reality of having the conversation and creating awareness around this and making the connection between what, you know, defence and national security people are talking about in terms of preparedness versus what we need to think about and talk about as the people who are responsible for feeding and clothing, you know, not just this nation, but tens of millions of others around the world, starts the process of taking fear out of it so that we can make way for really clear-eyed, you know, preparation, identifying our strategic vulnerabilities, understanding what they are so that we can mitigate those risks and put in place well-thought-through strategies to ensure that if, and God willing, it doesn't happen, but let's say if there's some kind of conflict in the Indo-Pacific that disrupts our access to the world, that we still have a reasonable degree of operating capacity for our own livelihoods and prosperity and an ability to be able to weather that storm for as long as it might take until, you know, things and situations could be normalized again. And I think that's where it needs to start. Now, one of the things that I want to touch on, you know, at Future Ag is the fact that the government did a good thing in terms of referring terms of reference for an inquiry into Australia's food security that was conducted ultimately by the House of Representatives Standing Committee on Agriculture over the course of last year. And that committee released a report that really has offered not the solutions, but some really proactive and constructive solutions that can get us going on the pathway to making sure that we can address the strategic vulnerabilities that we face as a sector. The inquiry was good in the sense that it submissions came from right across the supply chain, a range of organisations and government, and, you know, chief among them was that the government should establish a dedicated minister for food not just agriculture, but for food, that minister should be domiciled within Prime Minister and Cabinet, so a very senior position, that it should be then made responsible for creating a national foods plan, or, you know, call it a food security strategy, that would then be supported by, you know, a national food council. So that would be made up with representatives right across the ag sector, as well as defence and so on. For the first time, though, that report made a really strong linkage between the concept of food security and national security. And that's one thing that I'm really keen on, because I've just, you know, I can't get past the fact that hungry people are discontent. And discontent breeds instability. And that goes to the fundamental nature of food and what it does for our social cohesion, the stability of our society, but then the opportunities that we also have, you know, to be able to use our productive capacity in producing safe, high quality, and the reliable production of food to strengthen our relationships with our near neighbours and our regional partners, because that's where our security and the future of our security really does lie.
Yeah, you don't have to look too far to get good examples of where that happens. And first in my mind is obviously Sri Lanka, mm-hmm. with the effect of reducing people's ability to get hold of food. It's not a pleasant place to be, I would thought.
Absolutely.
So, Andrew, what about farmers? Okay, so what should we be thinking about at this time about this problem?
Well, I like to think about it in really practical terms. You know, maintaining a reasonable degree, understanding where you start and stop in terms of your own vulnerabilities, right? Maintaining a reasonable degree of operational capacity in a disrupted environment. That is, personally, my primary objective. You know, at home, behind the farm gate, so to speak. And that lesson was taught to us by COVID. And, you know, at that time, there was a lot of talk about the lack of access to things like spare parts, you know, planting time, chemicals, you know, and things of that nature, fertilizer, and some of those key inputs, because of how our supply chains have evolved into just-in-time supply chains. And the reality is I don't think that we've done a great deal to try and address some of those issues. You know, and shore up and mitigate some of that risk since then. It was a big issue, but then, you know, as humans, we have this awesome ability to be able to just gloss over something bad or negative that happened in the not-so-distant past and think that, oh, well, we're past that now, things will get back to normal. I think that we should reassess what our understanding of normal is. And, you know, I sort of had the view that if it's good enough for our defence and national security folks to be talking and preparing for a potentially volatile and incredibly disrupted future, then it should be good enough for us too. And I guess that applies very much, you know, at a personal level. And I think understanding your own vulnerabilities and knowing how to ensure that you can maintain, as I said, a reasonable degree of operational capacity in a disrupted environment, I think would be critical and a good place to start.
I think it's one of the things that interests me about that whole thing, and obviously having read some of your articles, was it's one of the things you take for granted is the logistics around food. And I think you're right, COVID taught us a few lessons, but if you look at, for instance, our maritime fleet, most of it is, Australia has a very small one, doesn't it? Does it have one?
It's the short answer. I shouldn't laugh. It's a very serious matter. But yeah, we have all but next to nothing in terms of our own sovereign fleet, you know, especially, you know, by comparison to how much we're reliant on maritime trade.
Yeah.
The government commissioned or created a strategic fleet task force when it got elected to look at, you know, with a view to looking at the creation of obtaining up to 14 Australian flagged vessels. And I think that body of work or the report has been released. And I think there's a recommendation to add 12 vessels back into an Australian strategic fleet, but excuse the pun, it's probably a drop in the ocean in terms of what would be required. Although I would direct people to get onto the Australian Strategic Policy Institute's website, because there's been some really interesting work done on that very, very recently, and particularly looking at, you know, rethinking how Australia's maritime trade would work in a wartime context. And some of that stuff's come out as recently as this week. So it'd be definitely worth listeners, because you know, realistically, everything changes in the context of conflict. And, you know, we don't think about necessarily these things in peacetime, but, you know, we're seeing a bit of a taste of it now with what's happened, you know, in the Red Sea with regard to the Houthis and, you know, that's been playing out as a result, in part at least, of the Israeli-Gaza conflict. But things like insurability, you know, shipping freight. And there's people around the place like Peter Court, who, you know, is very, very experienced in this space. And, you know, he's written quite extensively about Australia's vulnerability, you know, in that regard. And it's something that we do absolutely need to focus on. I mean, people would be experiencing it now just in, I guess, let's call it peacetime, just in the availability of super right now is it's tough stuff to get a hold of.
Yeah.
And there's ships that were supposed to be coming last week and the week before that and the week before that. And product is not arriving in country in a way that it might have done in years gone by as a result of current challenges in supply chains globally. So, you know, the maritime scenario is absolutely huge. A colleague of mine, Elizabeth Jackson from Curtin University over in the West, put it really succinctly when she gave me a statement once where she said, you know, Australia is out of the way of the northern east-west trade routes. So that means we're off the beaten track. We're at the end of the line. And I think it was a fellow called Richard Dunley, actually, in ASPE recently, that basically said we're on the way to nowhere else. so you know, that means that we're at the end of the line and effectively expendable. And we're not just saying that. It's not just myself and others that are, they're trying to highlight the risk associated with that. We were taught that lesson in the First and the Second World Wars. And there's some really interesting stuff if listeners wanted to dig around and do a little bit of research on effectively what happened to Australia from a trade perspective during both of those global conflicts. And it didn't just go to, you know, Australia's capacity to be able to assist the war effort. It went to our solvency as an economy, again, because we're so trade exposed. So these are the types of issues that we've been trying to, you know, kick around and think about.
So, again, that brings me back to the first question. I think what we've done is taken a discussion and actually flipped it on its head. And rather thinking about food security as a, well, we've got all this food and we export it all, therefore we're fine. The very fact that we do export all this food means that we're more dependent on international trade than a lot of countries around the world. So the relationship between national security and food security is actually quite strong and something that we should be aware of.
Absolutely. You know, I kind of say that our prosperity is contingent upon our access to the world at a very, very fundamental level. And, you know, geopolitics has this kind of nasty way of being able to reach from all the way over the other side of the world, right through your farm gate and into your livelihood and affect it overnight because of that. And that's just the nature of the world that we're living in. And you know, because of that fracturing of the post-Second World War, you know, Western-influenced, liberal-oriented world order and the strategic competition that's coming out of, you know, countries like China and Russia and others as well, means that, you know, we have to expect that we're going to be doing business in a much more contested environment. And you know, I like to say, you know, in terms of being optimistic, there's always got to be opportunity in broken players, the way I see it. The world's always going to want what we produce. It's just the terms on how we access the world and the terms of trade in that regard may not necessarily be as favourable to us in the past. But I think there are ways, you know, that we can look at that, you know, look at that with optimism because of what we do. But the key is making sure that the link between food security and our national security is well understood, you know, not just by security and defence policymakers, but by we ourselves as producers, as farmers, as growers of food and fibre. We need to understand our role in Australia's national security and stability and the opportunities that exist to assist the security and the stability of our region and view ourselves in a much more fundamentally important way than perhaps what we have done, you know, because of the stability of our operating environment over the last, you know, period of time.
Andrew, that's a great message, I think, to finish off the podcast on. As I've spoken before, Andrew's a keynote speaker at the Future Ag Trade Exhibition, which is going to be held on the 17th and 18th and 19th of April at the Melbourne Showground. If you just go to the website, you can get the tickets. But Andrew will be obviously expanding on his discussion we've had today, and I think it'll be pretty interesting. I've certainly taken a lot out of it, Andrew, so thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. It's really good to talk to you, David, and I look forward to seeing you there.
No worries, mate.
Thanks for listening to this week's Marcus Oldham College Ag Talk podcast. Please, any feedback on the series would be greatly appreciated. You can either leave a message on the site or email me at cornish@marcusoldham.vic.edu.au. Stay tuned as we continue to explore issues affecting Australian agribusiness.